Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Colorado Kid by Stephen King. Read by Jeffrey DeMunn.
One. After deciding he would get nothing of interest from the two old men who comprised the entire staff of the Weekly Islander, the feature writer from the Boston Globe took a look at his watch, remarked that he could just make the 1:30 ferry back to the mainland if he hurried, thanked them for their time, dropped some money on the tablecloth, weighted it down with the salt shaker so the stiffish onshore breeze wouldn't blow it away, and hurried down the stone steps from the Gray Gulls patio dining area toward Bay Street and the little town below. Other than a few cursory gleeps at her breasts, he hardly noticed the young woman sitting between the two old men at all. Once the Globe writer was gone, Vince Teague reached across the table and removed the bills, $2.50s, from beneath the salt shaker. He tucked them into a flap pocket of his old but serviceable tweed jacket with a look of unmistakable satisfaction. "What are you doing?" Stephanie McCann asked, knowing how much Vince enjoyed shocking what he called her young bones. How much they both did, really, but in this instance, not able to keep the shock out of her voice.
"What does it look like?"
Vince looked more satisfied than ever. With the money gone, he smoothed down the flap over the pocket and took the last bite of his lobster roll. Then he patted his mouth with his paper napkin and deftly caught the departed Globe writer's plastic lobster bib when another, fresher gust of salt-scented breeze tried to carry it away. His hand was almost grotesquely gnarled with arthritis, but mighty quick for all that. "It looks like you just took the money Mr. Hanratty left to pay for our lunch," Stephanie said.
"Yeah, good eye there, Steph,"
Vince agreed and winked one of his own at the other man sitting at the table. This was Dave Bowie, who looked roughly Vince Teague's age, but was, in fact, 25 years younger. It was all a matter of the equipment you got in the lottery, was what Vince claimed. You ran it until it fell apart, patching it up as needed along the way. And he was sure that even to folks who lived 100 years, as he hoped to do, it seemed like not much more than a summer afternoon in the end. But why?
"Are you afraid I'm going to stiff the golf for the tab and stick Helen with it?" he asked her.
"No. Who's Helen?"
"Helen Hafner, she who waited on us?"
Vince nodded across the patio, where a slightly overweight woman of about 40 was picking up dishes.
"Because it's the policy of Jack Moody, who happens to own this fine eating establishment, and his father before him, if you care."
"I do," she said. David Bowie, the Weekly Islander's managing editor for just shy of the years Helen Hafner had lived, leaned forward and put his pudgy hand over her young and pretty one.
"I know you do," he said. "Vince does, too. That's why he's taken the long way around Robin Hood's band to explain."
"Because school is in," she said, smiling.
"That's right," Dave said. "And what's nice for old guys like us?"
"You only have to bother teaching people who want to learn."
"That's right," Dave said, and leaned back. "That's nice."
He wasn't wearing a suit coat or sport coat, but an old green sweater. It was August, and to Stephanie it seemed quite warm on the Gulls patio in spite of the onshore breeze, but she knew that both men felt the slightest chill. In Dave's case, this surprised her a little. He was only 65 and carrying an extra 30 pounds at least. But although Vince Teague might look no more than 70, and an agile 70 at that in spite of his twisted hands, he had turned 90 earlier that summer and was as skinny as a rail. A stuffed string was what Mrs. Pinder, the Islander's part-time secretary, called him, usually with a disdainful sniff.
"The Gray Gull's policy is that the waitresses are responsible for the tabs their tables run up until those tabs are paid," Vince said. "Jack tells all the ladies that when they come looking for work, just so they can't come whining to him later on saying they didn't know that was part of the deal.
Stephanie surveyed the patio, which was still half full even at 1:20, and then looked into the main dining room, which overlooked Moose Cove. There, almost every table was still taken, and she knew that from Memorial Day until the end of July, there would be a line outside until nearly 3 o'clock. Controlled bedlam, in other words. To expect every waitress to keep track of every single customer when she was busting her ass carrying trays of steaming boiled lobsters and clams? That hardly seems... She trailed off, wondering if these two old fellows, who'd probably been putting out their paper before such a thing as the minimum wage even existed, would laugh at her if she finished.
Fair might be the word you're looking for, Dave said dryly, and picked up a roll.
It was the last one in the basket. Fair came out Feya, which more or less rhymed with Aya, the Yankee word which seemed to mean both yes and is that so. Stephanie was from Cincinnati, Ohio, and when she had first come to Moose Lookout Island to do an internship on the Weekly Islander, she had nearly despaired, which in Down East lingo also rhymed with Aya. How could she learn anything when she could only understand one word in every seven? And if she kept asking them to repeat themselves, how long would it be before they decided she was a congenital idiot? Which on Moose Look was pronounced idiot, of course. She had been on the verge of quitting 4 days into a 4-month University of Ohio postgrad program when Dave took her aside one afternoon and said,
"Don't you quit on it, Steffi. It'll come to you."
And it had. Almost overnight, it seemed, the accent had clarified. It was as if she'd had a bubble in her ear which had suddenly miraculously popped. She thought she could live here the rest of her life and never talk like them. But understand them? Yeah,
that much she could do, dear.
Fair was the word, she agreed.
One that hasn't ever been in Jack Moody's vocabulary, except in how it applies to the weather, Vince said.
And then, with no change of tone,
"Put that roll down, David Bowie. Ain't you getting fat, I swan? Sweet pig, pig, pig!" "Last time I looked, we weren't married," Dave said, and took another bite of his roll. "Can't you tell her what's on what passes for your mind without scolding me?"
"Ain't he pit," Vince said. "No one ever taught him not to talk with his mouth full, either."
He hooked an arm over the back of his chair, and the breeze from the bright ocean blew his fine white hair back from his brow.
"Steffi, Helen's got 3 kids from 12 to 6, and a husband that run off and left her. She don't want to leave the island, and she can make a go of it, just waitressing at the Grey Gull because summers are a little fatter than the winter's Aileen. You follow that?"
"Yes, absolutely," Stephanie said. And just then the lady in question approached. Stephanie noticed that she was wearing heavy support hose that did not entirely conceal varicose veins, and that there were dark circles under her eyes.
"Vince, Dave," she said,
and contented herself with just a nod at the pretty third, whose name she did not know.
"So your friend dashed off for the ferry?"
"Yep," Dave said. "Discovered he had to get back down Boston."
"Yeah? All done here?" "Oh, leave on a bit," Vince said, "but bring us a check when you like, Helen. Kids okay?"
Helen Hafner grimaced.
"Jude fell out of his treehouse and broke his arm last week. Didn't he holler? Scared me bout to death."
The two old men looked at each other, then laughed. They sobered quickly, looking ashamed, and Vince offered his sympathies, but it wouldn't do for Helen.
"Men can laugh," she told Stephanie with a tired, sardonic smile. "They all fell out of treehouses and broke their arms when they were boys, and they all remember what little pirates they were. What they don't remember is Ma getting up in the middle of the night to give them their aspirin tablets. I'll bring you the check."
She shuffled off in a pair of sneakers with run-down backs.
"She's a good soul," Dave said,
having the grace to look slightly shamefaced.
"Yes, she is," Vince said. "And if we got the rough side of her tongue, we probably deserved it. Meanwhile, here's the deal on this lunch, Stuffy. I'd know what 3 lobster rolls, 1 lobster dinner with steamers and far iced teas cost down there in Boston. But that feature writer must have forgot that up here we're living at what an economist might call the sauce of supply. And so he dropped $100 on the table. If Helen brings us a check that says any more than 55, I'll smile and kiss a pig. With me so far?
Yes, sure, Stephanie said.
Well, the way this works for that fella from the Globe is that he scratches Lunch, Grey Gall, Moose Lookout Island, and Unexplained Mysteries series in his little Boston Globe expense book while he's riding back to the mainland on the ferry. And if he's honest, he writes $100. And if he's got a smidge of larceny in his soul, he writes 120 and takes his girl to the movies on the extra. You got that?
Yes, Stephanie said, and looked at him with reproachful eyes as she drank the rest of her iced tea. I think you're very cynical.
No, if I was very cynical, I would have said 130, and for sure.
This made Dave snort laughter.
In any case, he left 100, and that's at least $35 too much, even with a 20% tip added in. So I took his money. When Helen brings the check, I'll sign it, because the islander runs a tab here.
And you'll tip more than 20%, I hope, Stephanie said, given her situation at home.
That's just where you're wrong, Vince said.
I am? Why am I? He looked at her patiently.
Why do you think? Because I'm cheap, Yankee tight?
No, I don't believe that any more than I think black men are lazy or Frenchmen think about sex all day long.
Then put your brain to work. God gave you a good one.
Stephanie tried, and the 2 men watched her do it, interested.
She'd see it as charity, Stephanie finally said.
Vince and Dave exchanged an amused glance.
What? Stephanie asked.
Getting a little close to lazy black men and sexy Frenchmen, ain't ya, dear?
Dave asked, deliberately broadening his Down East accent into what was nearly a burlesque drawl.
Only now, it's a proud Yankee woman who won't take charity.
Feeling that she was straying ever deeper into the sociological thickets, Stephanie said, "You mean she would take it, for her kids, if not for herself."
The man who bought our lunch was from away, Vince said. As far as Helen Hefner's concerned, folks from away just about got money falling out of their wallets.
Amused at his sudden detour into delicacy on her account, Stephanie looked around, first at the patio area where they were sitting, then through the glass at the indoor seating area. And she saw an interesting thing. Many, perhaps even most, of the patrons out here in the breeze were locals, and so were most of the waitresses serving them. Inside were the summer people, the so-called off-islanders, and the waitresses serving them were younger, prettier too, and also from away. Summer help. And all at once, she understood. She had been wrong to put on her sociologist's hat. It was far simpler than that. The Grey Gull waitresses share tips, don't they? She asked. That's what it is. Vince pointed a finger at her like a gun and said,
Bingo.
So what do you do?
What I do, he said, is tip 15% when I sign the check and put $40 of that Globe fella's cash in Helen's pocket. She gets all of that. The paper doesn't get hurt, and what Uncle Sam don't know, don't bother him.
It's the way America does business, Dave said solemnly.
And you know what I like?
Vince Teague said, turning his face up into the sun. When he squinted, his eyes closed against its brilliance. What seemed like 1,000 wrinkles sprang into existence on his skin. They did not make him look his age, but they did make him look 80.
No, what? Stephanie asked, amused.
I like the way the money goes around and around like clothes in a dryer. I like watching it. And this time, when the machine finally starts turning, the money finishes up here on Moosey, where folks actually need it. Also, just to make it perfect, that city fellow did pay for our lunch, and he walked away with nuns.
Ran, actually, Dave said. Had to make that boat, don't you know.
made me think of that Edna St. Vincent Millay poem. We were very tired. We were very merry. We went back and forth all night on the ferry. It's not exactly it, but it's close.
He wasn't very merry, but he'll be good and tired by the time he gets to his next stop, Vince said.
I think he mentioned Madawaska. Maybe he'll find some unexplained mysteries there. Why anyone would want to live in such a place, for instance.
Dave, help me out.
Stephanie believed there was a kind of telepathy between the two old men, rough but real. She'd seen several examples of it since coming to Moose Lookout Island almost 3 months ago, and she saw another example of it now. Their waitress was returning, check in hand. Dave's back was to her, but Vince saw her coming, and the younger man knew exactly what the Islander's editor wanted. Dave reached into his back pocket, removed his wallet, removed two bills, folded them between his fingers, and passed them across the table. Helen arrived a moment later. Vince took the check from her with one gnarled hand. With the other, he slipped the bills into the skirt pocket of her uniform.
"Thank you, darling," he said. "You sure you don't want dessert?" she asked. "There's Mac's chocolate cherry cake. It's not on the menu, but we've still got some." "I'll pass, Steffi."
She shook her head. So, with some regret, did Dave Bowie. Helen favored, if that was the word, Vincent Teague, with a look of dour judgment.
"You could use fattening up, Vince." "Jack Spratt and his wife, that's me and Dave," Vince said brightly. "Yeah?"
Helen glanced at Stephanie, and one of her tired eyes closed in a brief wink of surprising good humor.
"You picked a pair, missy," she said.
"They're all right," Stephanie said.
"Sure. And after this, you'll probably go straight to the New York Times," Helen said.
She picked up the plates, added, "I'll be back for the rest of the ridding up," and sailed away. "When she finds that $40 in her pocket," Stephanie said, "will she know who put it there?" She looked again at the patio, where perhaps 24 customers were drinking coffee, iced tea, afternoon beers, or eating off the menu chocolate cherry cake. Not all looked capable of slipping $40 in cash into a waitress's pocket, but some of them did.
"Probably she will," Vince said. "But tell me something, Steffi."
"I will if I can."
"If she didn't know, would that make it illegal tender?"
"I don't know what you..."
"I think you do," he said. "Come on, let's get back to the paper. News won't wait."
2. Here was the thing Stephanie loved best about the Weekly Islander, the thing that still charmed her after 3 months spent mostly writing ads. On a clear afternoon, you could walk 6 steps from your desk and have a gorgeous view of the main coast. All you had to do was walk onto the shaded deck that overlooked the reach and ran the length of the newspaper's barn-like building. It was true that the air smelled of fish and seaweed, but everything on Moose Look smelled that way. You got used to it, Stephanie had discovered, and then a beautiful thing happened. After your nose dismissed that smell, it went and found it all over again. And the second time around, you fell in love with it. On clear afternoons like this one near the end of August, every house and dock and fishing boat over there on the Tinnock side of the reach stood out brilliantly. She could read the Sunoco on the side of a diesel pump and the Lily Bet on the hull of some haddock jockey's breadwinner, beached for its turn-of-the-season scraping and painting. She could see a boy in shorts and a cut-off Patriots jersey fishing from the trash-littered shingle below Preston's bar, and 1,000 winks of sun glittering off the tin flashing of 100 village roofs. And between Tinnock Village, which was actually a good-sized town, and Moose Lookout Island, the sun shone on the bluest water she had ever seen. On days like this, she wondered how she would ever go back to the Midwest, or if she even could. And on days when the fog rolled in, and the entire mainland world seemed to be canceled, and the rueful cry of the foghorn came and went like the voice of some ancient beast, why then, she wondered the same thing.
"You want to be careful, Steffi,"
Dave had told her one day when he came on her sitting out there on the deck with her yellow pad on her lap and a half-finished Arts and Things column scrawled there in her big backhand strokes.
"Island living has a way of creeping into your blood. And once it gets there, it's like malaria. Doesn't leave easily.
Now, after turning on the lights, the sun had begun going the other way and the long room had begun to darken. She sat down at her desk and found her trusty legal pad with a new Arts and Things column on the top page. This one was pretty much interchangeable with any of half a dozen others she had so far turned in, but she looked at it with undeniable affection just the same. It was hers, after all. Her work. Writing she was getting paid for. And she had no doubt that people all over the Islander's circulation area, which was quite large, actually read it. Vince sat down behind his own desk with a small but audible grunt. It was followed by a crackling sound as he twisted first to the left and then to the right. He called this settling his spine. Dave told him that he would someday paralyze himself from the neck down while settling his spine, but Vince seemed singularly unworried by the possibility. Now he turned on his computer while his managing editor sat on the corner of his desk, produced a toothpick, and began using it to rummage in his upper plate.
"What's it going to be?" Dave asked while Vince waited for his computer to boot up. "Fire? Flood? Earthquake? Or the revolt of the multitudes?"
"I thought I'd start with Ellen Dunwoody snapping off the fire hydrant on Beach Lane when the pack and brake on her car let go. And once I'm properly warmed up, I thought I'd move on to a rewrite of my library editorial," Vince said, and cracked his knuckles.
Dave glanced over at Stephanie from his perch on the corner of Vince's desk.
"First the back, then the knuckles," he said. "If he could learn how to play dry bones on his ribcage, we could get him on American Idol."
"Always a critic," Vince said amiably,
waiting for his machine to boot up. "You know, Steph, there's something perverse about this. Here am I, 90 years old and ready for the cooling bud, using a brand new Macintosh computer. And there you sit, 22 and gorgeous, fresh as a new peach, yet scrawling on a yellow legal pad like an old maid in a Victorian romance."
"I don't believe yellow legal pads had been invented in Victorian times," Stephanie said. She shuffled through the papers on her desk. When she had come to Moose Look and the Weekly Islander in June, they had given her the smallest desk in the place, little more than a grade schooler's desk, really, away in the corner. In mid-July, she had been promoted to a bigger one in the middle of the room. This pleased her, but the increased desk space also afforded more area for things to get lost in. Now she hunted around until she found a bright pink circular. "Do either of you know what organization profits from the annual end-of-summer Gurnard Farms hayride, picnic, and dance, this year featuring Little Jonna Jay and the Straw Hill Boys?"
"That organization would be Sam Gurnard, his wife, their 5 kids, and their various creditors," Vince said, and his machine beeped. "I've been meaning to tell you, Steph, you've done a swell job on that little column of yours."
"Yes, you have," Dave agreed. "We've gotten 2 dozen letters, I guess. The only bad one was from Mrs. Adina Steen, the Downeast grammar queen, and she's completely mad."
"Nuttier than a fruitcake," Vince agreed.
Stephanie smiled, wondering at how rare it was, once you graduated from childhood, this feeling of perfect and uncomplicated happiness. "Thank you," she said. "Thank you both." And then, "Can I ask you something straight up?" Vince swiveled his chair around and looked at her.
"Anything under the sun if it'll keep me away from Mrs. Dunwoody and the fire hydrant," he said.
"And me away from doing invoices," Dave said. "Although I can't go home until they're finished."
"Don't you make that paperwork your boss," Vince said. "How many times have I told you?"
"Easy for you to say," Dave returned. "You haven't looked inside the Islander checkbook in 10 years, I don't think, let alone carried it around."
Stephanie was determined not to let them be sidetracked, or to let them sidetrack her into this old squabble. "Quit it, both of you." They looked at her, surprised, into silence. "Dave, you pretty much told that Mr. Hanratty from the Globe that you and Vince have been working together on the Islander for 40 years.
Yeah.
And you started it up in 1948, Vince.
That's true, he said. 'Twas the weekly shopper and trading post until the summer of 48. Just a free handout in the various island markets and the biggest stores on the mainland. I was young and bullheaded and awful lucky. That was when they had the big fires over in Tinoch and Hancock. Oh, those fires. They didn't make the paper, I won't say that, although there were those who did at the time. But they give it a good running stat, sure. It wasn't until 1956 that I had as many ads as I did in the summer of 48.
So, you guys have been on the job for over 50 years, and in all that time you've never come across a real unexplained mystery? Can that be true? Dave Bowie looked shocked.
We never said that.
Glory, you were there,
Vince declared, equally scandalized. For a moment, they managed to hold these expressions, but when Stephanie McCann only continued to look from one to the other, prim as the schoolmarm in a John Ford Western, they couldn't go on. First, Vince Teague's mouth began to quiver at one corner, and then Dave Bowie's eye began to twitch. They might still have been all right, but then they made the mistake of looking right at each other. And a moment later, they were laughing, like the world's oldest pair of kids. 3.
You were the one who told him about the pretty Lisa, Dave said to Vince when he had gotten hold of himself again.
The pretty Lisa Cabot was a fishing boat that had washed up on the shore of neighboring Smack Island in the 1920s, with one dead crewman sprawled over the forward hold and the other five men gone.
How many times do you think Conrady heard that one up and down this part of the coast?
Oh, I don't know. How many places do you judge he stopped before he got here, dear?
Vince countered, and a moment later the two men were off again, bellowing laughter, Vince slapping his bony knee while Dave whacked the side of one plump thigh. Stephanie watched them, frowning, not angry, not amused herself, well, a little, just trying to understand the source of their howling good humor. She herself had thought the story of the pretty Lisa Cabot good enough for at least one in a series of 8 articles on Ta-da! Unexplained Mysteries of New England, but she was neither stupid nor insensitive. She'd been perfectly aware that Mr. Hanratty hadn't thought it was good enough. And yes, she'd known from his face that he'd heard it before in his globe-funded wanderings up and down the coast between Boston and Moose Look, and probably more than once. Vince and Dave nodded when she advanced this idea.
Well, Dave said, Hanratty may be from away, but that doesn't make him lazy or stupid. The mystery of the pretty Lisa, the solution to which almost certainly has to do with gun happy bootleggers running hooch down from Canada, although no one will ever know for sure, has been around for years. It's been written up in 6 books, not to mention both Yankee and Down East magazines. And say, Vince, didn't the Globe?
Vince was nodding.
Maybe 7, maybe 9 years ago, Sunday supplement piece. Although it might have been the Providence Journal. I'm sure it was the Portland Sunday Telegram that did the piece on the Mormons that showed up over in Freeport and tried to sink a mine in the desert of Maine. And the 1951 coastlights get a big play in the newspapers almost every Halloween, Dave added cheerfully, not to mention the UFO websites. And a woman wrote a book last year on the poisonings at that church picnic in Tashmore, Vince finished up.
This was the last unexplained mystery they had hauled out for the Globe reporter over lunch. This was just before Hanratty had decided he could make the 1:30 ferry, and in a way Stephanie guessed she now didn't blame him. So you were having him on, she said, teasing him with old stories.
No, dear,
Vince said, this time sounding shocked for real. Well, maybe, Stephanie thought.
Every one of those is a bona fide, unsolved mystery of the New England coast, or a part of it even. We couldn't be sure he knew all those stories until we trotted them out, Dave said reasonably. Not that it surprised us any that he did.
Nope, Vince agreed. His eyes were bright. Pretty old chestnuts, I would have to agree. But we got a nice lunch out of it, didn't we?
and we got to watch the money go around and come out right where it should, patently in Helen Hafner's pocket.
And those stories are really the only ones you know? Stories that have been chewed to a pulp in books and the big newspapers?
Vince looked at Dave, his longtime cohort.
Did I say that?
Nope, Dave said. I don't believe I did either.
Well, what other unexplained mysteries do you know about, and why didn't you tell him? The two old men glanced at each other, and once again Stephanie McCann felt that telepathy at work. Vince gave a slight nod toward the door. Dave got up, crossed the brightly lit half of the long room. In the darker half hulked the big, old-fashioned offset printing press that hadn't run in over 7 years, and turned the sign hanging in the door from open to closed. Then he came back.
Closed? In the middle of the day? Stephanie asked, with the slightest touch of unease in her mind, if not in her voice.
If someone comes by with news, they'll knock, Vince said reasonably enough. If it's big news, they'll hammer. And if downtown catches a fire, we'll hear the whistle, Dave put in. Come on out on the deck, Steffi. August sun's not to be missed. It doesn't last long.
She looked at Dave, then at Vince Teague, who was as mentally quick at 90 as he'd been at 45, she was convinced of it.
School's in? She asked.
That's right, Vince said,
and although he was still smiling, she sensed he was serious.
And you know what's nice for old guys like us?
You only have to teach people who want to learn.
You want to learn, Steffi?
Yes. She spoke with no hesitation, in spite of that odd inner unease.
Then come out and sit, he said. Come out and sit a little.
So she did. 4. The sun was warm, the air was cool, the breeze was sweet with salt and rich with the sound of bells and horns and lapping water. These were sounds she had come to love in only a space of weeks. The two men sat on either side of her, and although she didn't know it, both had more or less the same thought. Age flanks beauty. And there was nothing wrong with the thought, because both of them understood their intentions were perfectly solid. They understood how good she could be at this job, and how much she wanted to learn. All that pretty greed made you want to teach.
So, Vince said when they were settled, think about those stories we told Hanratty at lunch, Steffi. The Lisa Cabot, the Coast Lights, the Wandering Mormons, the Tashmar Church poisonings that were never solved, and tell me what they have in common.
They're all unsolved.
Try doing a little better, dear heart, Dave said. You disappoint me.
She glanced at him and saw he wasn't kidding. Well, that was pretty obvious, considering why Hanratty had blown them to lunch in the first place. The Globe's 8-installment series, maybe even 10 installments, Hanratty had said, if he could find enough peculiar stories, which the editorial staff hoped to run between September and Halloween.
They've all been done to death?
That's a little better, Vince said, but you're still not breaking any new ground. Ask yourself this, youngster. Why have they been done to death? Why does some New England paper drag up the Coast Lights at least once a year, along with a bunch of blurry photos taken over half a century ago? Why does some regional magazine like Yankee or Coast interview either Clayton Riggs or Ella Ferguson at least once a year, as if they were going to all at once jump up like Satan in silk breeches and say something brand new?
I don't know who those people are, Stephanie said. Vince clapped a hand to the back of his head.
Well, more fool me, I keep forgetting you're from away.
Should I take that as a compliment?
Could do. Probably should do. Clayton Riggs and Ella Ferguson were the only two who drank the iced coffee that day at Tashmar Lake and didn't die of it. The Ferguson woman's all right, but Riggs is paralyzed all down the left side of his body.
That's awful. And they keep interviewing them?
Yeah. 15 years have rolled by, and I think everyone with half a brain knows that no one is ever going to be arrested for that crime. 8 folks poisoned by the side of the lake
and 6 of them dead, but still, Ferguson and Riggs show up in the press looking increasingly rickety. What happened that day, and the Lakeside Horror, and you get the idea. It's just another story folks like to hear, like Little Red Riding Hood or the Three Billy Goats Gruff. Question is, why?
But Stephanie had leapt ahead. There is something, isn't there, she said. Some story you didn't tell him. What is it? Again, that look passed between them, and this time she couldn't come even close to reading the thought that went with it. They were sitting in identical lawn chairs, Stephanie with her hands on the arms of hers. Now Dave reached over and patted one of them.
We don't mind telling you, do we, Vince? No, guess not, Vince said, and once again all those wrinkles appeared as he smiled up into the sun. But if you want to ride the ferry, you have to bring tea for the tiller man. Have you ever heard that one?
Somewhere, she thought on one of her mom's old record albums up in the attic.
Okay, Dave said, then answer the question. Hanratty didn't want those stories because they've been written to rags. Why have they been?
She thought about it, and once again they let her. Once again took pleasure in watching her do it. Well, Stephanie said at last, I suppose people like stories that are good for a shiver or two on a winter night, especially if the lights are on and the fire's nice and warm. Stories about, you know, the unknown.
How many unknown things per story, dear? Vince Teague asked.
His voice was soft, but his eyes were sharp. She opened her mouth to say as many as 6 anyway, thinking about the church picnic poisoner, then closed it again. 6 people had died that day on the shores of Tashmore Lake, but one whopper dose of poison had killed them all, and she guessed that just one hand had administered it. She didn't know how many coast lights there had been, but had no doubt that folks thought of it as a single phenomenon. So? One, she said, feeling like a contestant in the final Jeopardy round. One unknown thing per story? Vince pointed his finger at her, smiling more widely than ever, and Stephanie relaxed. This wasn't real school, and these 2 men wouldn't like her any less if she flubbed an answer, but she had come to want to please them in a way she had only wanted to please the very best of her high school and college teachers, the ones who were fierce in their commitments.
The other thing is that folks have to believe in their hearts that there's a must-have-been in there someplace. And they got a damn good idea what it is, Dave said. Here's the pretty Lisa, washed up on the rocks just south of Dingle Nook on Smack Island in 1926. 27, Vince said. All right, 27, Smatty Britches. And Theodore Rippenau is still on board, but dead as a hake. And the other 5 are gone. And even though there's no sign of blood or a struggle, folks say must have been pirates. So now there's stories about how they had a treasure map and found buried gold, and the folks that were guarding it took the swag off them and who knows what all else. They got fighting amongst themselves, Vince said. That's always been a pretty Lisa favorite. The point is there are stories some folks tell and other folks like to hear. But Hanratty was wise enough to know his editor wouldn't fall for such reheated hash. In another 10 years, maybe, Dave said, because sooner or later, everything old is new again. You might not believe that, Steffi, but it's actually true.
I do believe it, she said, and thought, tea for the tiller man. Was that Al Stewart or Cat Stevens?
Then there's the coast lights, Vince said. I can tell you exactly what's always made that such a favorite. There's a picture of them. Probably nothing but reflected lights from Ellsworth on the low clouds that hung together just right to make circles that looked like saucers. And below them, you can see the whole Hancock Lumber Little League team looking up, all in their uniforms. And one little boy pointing with his glove, Dave said. It's the final touch. And people all look at it and say, why, that must have been folks from outer space, dropping down for a little look, say, at the great American pastime. But it's still just one unknown thing, this time with interesting pictures to mull over, so people go back to it again and again. But not the Boston Globe, Vince said, although I sense that one might do in a pinch.
The two men laughed comfortably, as old friends will.
So, Vince said, we might know of an unexplained mystery or two. I won't stick at that, Dave said. We know of at least one for sure, darling, but there isn't a single must-have-been about it. Well, the stake, Vince said, but he sounded doubtful. Oh, I are, but even that's a mystery, wouldn't you say? Dave asked. Yeah, Vince agreed, and now he didn't sound comfortable, nor did he look it.
You're confusing me, Stephanie said.
Yeah, the story of the Colorado Kid is a confusing tale, all right, Vince said. Which is why it wouldn't do for the Boston Globe, don't you know? Too many unknowns to begin with. Not a single must have been for another.
He leaned forward, fixing her with his clear blue Yankee gaze.
You want to be a newswoman, don't you?
You know I do, Stephanie said, surprised.
Well, then, I'm going to tell you a secret almost every newspaper man and woman who's been at it a while knows. In real life, the number of actual stories, those with beginnings, middles, and ends, as slim and none. But if you can give your readers just one unknown thing, two at the very outside, and then kick in what Dave Bowie there calls a must-have-been, your reader will tell himself a story. Amazing, ain't it? Take the church picnic poisonings. No one knows who killed those folks. What is known is that Rhoda Pax, the Tashmore Methodist Church secretary, and William Blakey, the Methodist Church pastor, had a brief affair 6 months before the poisonings. Blakey was married, and he broke it off. Are you with me?
Yes, Stephanie said.
What's also known is that Rhoda Pax was despondent over the breakup, at least for a while. Her sister said as much. A third thing that's known, both Rhoda Pax and William Blakey drank that poisoned iced coffee at the picnic and died. So what's the must have been? Quick as your life, Steffi.
Rhoda must have poisoned the coffee to kill her lover for jilting her and then drank it herself to commit suicide. The other four, plus the ones who only got sick, were, what do you call it, collateral damage. Vince snapped his fingers.
Yeah, that's the story people tell themselves. The newspapers and magazines never come right out and print it because they don't have to. They know that folks can connect the dots. What's against it? Quick as your life again.
But this time her life would have been forfeit because Stephanie could come up with nothing against it. She was about to protest that she didn't know the case well enough to say when Dave got up, approached the porch rail, looked out over the reach toward Tinnock, and remarked mildly,
6 months? Seems a long time to wait, doesn't it?
Stephanie said, didn't someone once say revenge is a dish best eaten cold?
Yeah, Dave said, still perfectly mild. But when you kill 6 people, that's more than just revenge. Not saying it couldn't have been that way, just that it might have been some other. Just like the coast lights might have been reflections on the clouds. Something secret the Air Force was testing that got sent up from the air base in Bangor. Who knows, maybe it was little green men dropping in to see if the kids from Hancock Lumber could turn a double play against the ones from Tinnock Auto Body. Mostly what happens is people make up a story and stick with it, Vince said. That's easy enough to do as long as there's only one unknown factor, one poisoner. One set of mystery lights, one boat run aground with most of the crew gone. But with the Colorado Kid, there was nothing but unknown factors, and hence there was no story. He paused. It was like a train running out of a fireplace, or a bunch of horses' heads showing up one morning in the middle of your driveway. Not that grand, but every bit as strange. And things like that, he shook his head. Steffi, People don't like things like that. They don't want things like that. A wave is a pretty thing to look at when it breaks on a beach, but too many only make you seasick.
Stephanie looked out at the sparkling reach, plenty of waves there, but no big ones, not today, and considered this in silence.
There's something else, Dave said after a bit.
What? She asked.
It's ours, he said, and with surprising force.
She thought it was almost anger.
A guy from the globe, a guy from away, he'd only muck it up. He wouldn't understand.
Do you? She asked.
No,
he said, sitting down again.
Nor do I have to, dear. On the subject of the Colorado Kid, I'm a little like the Virgin Mary after she gave birth to Jesus. The Bible says something like, but Mary kept silent and pondered these things in her heart. Sometimes, with mysteries, that's best.
But you'll tell me?
Why, yes, ma'am.
He looked at her as if surprised, also a little as if awakening from a near doze.
Because you're one of us, ain't she, Vince?
I am. Vince said. You passed that test somewhere around midsummer.
Did I? Again, she felt absurdly happy. How? What test? Vince shook his head.
Can't say, dear. Only know that at some point it began to seem you were all right.
He glanced at Dave, who nodded. Then he looked back at Stephanie.
All right, he said. A story we didn't tell at lunch. Our very own unexplained mystery. The story of the Colorado Kid.
Five. But it was Dave who actually began.
25 years ago, he said, back in 80, there were two kids who took the 6:30 ferry to school instead of the 7:30. They were on the Bayview Consolidated High School track team, and they were also boy and girlfriend. Once winter was over, it doesn't ever last as long here on the coast as it does inland, they'd run cross-island, down Long Hammock Beach to the main road, then on to Bay Street and the town dock. Do you see it, Steffi?
She did. She saw the romance of it as well. What she didn't see was what the boy and girlfriend did when they got on the Tinnock side of the reach. She knew that Moosluk's dozen or so high school-age kids almost always took the 7:30 ferry, giving the ferryman, either Herbie Goslin or Marcy Lagasse, their passes so they could be recorded with quick winks of the old laser gun on the barcodes. Then, on the Tinnock side, a school bus would be waiting to take them the 3 miles to BCHS. She asked if the runners waited for the bus, and Dave shook his head, smiling.
Nope. Ran that side, too, he said. Not holding hands, it might as well have been. Always side by side, Johnny Gravelin and Nancy Arnault. For a couple of years, they were all but inseparable.
Stephanie sat up straighter in her chair. The John Gravelin she knew was Moose Lookout Island's mayor, a gregarious man with a good word for everyone and an eye on the state senate in Augusta. His hairline was receding, his belly expanding. She tried to imagine him doing the greyhound thing, 2 miles a day on the island side of the reach, 3 more on the mainland side, and couldn't manage it.
Ain't making much progress with it, are you, dear? Vince asked.
No, she admitted.
Well, that's because you see Johnny Gravelin, the soccer player, miler, Friday night practical joker, and Saturday lover as Mayor John Gravelin, who happens to be the only political hop-toad in a small island pond. He goes up and down Bay Street, shaking hands and grinning with that gold tooth flashing off to one side in his mouth. Got a good word for everyone he meets, never forgets a name or which man drives a Ford pickup and which one is still getting along with his dad's old International Harvester. He's a caricature right out of an old 1940s movie about small-town hop-to-do politics. He's such a hick he don't even know it. He's got one jump left in him, hop, toad, hop. And once he gets to that Augusta lily pad, he'll either be wise enough to stop, or he'll try another hop and end up getting squashed.
That's so cynical, Stephanie said, not without youth's admiration for the trait.
Vince shrugged his bony shoulders. Hey,
I'm a stereotype myself, dearie. Only my movie's the one where the newspaper fella with the arm garters on his shirt and the eye shade on his forehead gets to yell out, "Stop the presses!" in the last reel. My point is that Johnny was a different creature in those days. Slim as a quill pen and quick as quicksilver. You would have called him a god almost, except for those unfortunate buck teeth, which he has since had fixed. And she, in those skimpy little red shorts she was indeed a goddess. He paused. As so many girls of 17 surely are.
Get your mind out of the gutter, Dave told him.
Vince looked surprised.
Ain't, he said. Ain't a bit. It's in the clouds.
If you say so, Dave said.
And I will admit she was a looker, all right. And an inch or two taller than Johnny, which may be why they broke up in the spring of their senior year. But back in 80, they were hot and heavy, and every day they'd run for the ferry on this side and then up Bayview Hill to the high school on the Tinnock side. There were bets on when Nancy would catch pregnant by him, but she never did. Either he was awful polite or she was awful careful.
He paused.
Ah, hell, maybe they were just a little more sophisticated than most island kids back then.
I think it might have been the running, Vince said judiciously. Stephanie said, back on message, please, both of you, and the man laughed.
On message, Dave said.
There came a mining in the spring of 1980, April it would have been, when they spied a man sitting out on Hammock Beach. You know, just on the outskirts of the village.
Stephanie knew it well. Hammock Beach was a lovely spot, if a little overpopulated with summer people. She couldn't imagine what it would be like after Labor Day, although she would get a chance to see. Her internship ran through the 5th of October.
Well, not exactly sitting, Dave amended. Half sprawling was how they both put it later on. He was up against one of those litter baskets, don't you know, and their bases are planted down in the sand to keep him from blowing away in a strong wind. But the man's weight had settled back against this one until the can was...
Dave held his hand up to the vertical, then tilted it. Until it was like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, Steffi said.
You got it exactly. Also, he aren't hardly dressed for early morning. With the thermometer running maybe 32 degrees and a fresh breeze off the water making it feel more like 32, he was wearing nice gray slacks and a white shirt, loafers on his feet, no coat, no gloves. The youngsters didn't even discuss it. They just ran over to see if he was okay, and right away they knew he wasn't. Johnny said later that he knew the man was dead as soon as he saw his face, and Nancy said the same thing. But of course they didn't want to admit it. Would you, not making sure?
No, Stephanie said.
He was just sitting there, well, half sprawling there, with one hand in his lap, and the other, the right one, lying on the sand. His face was waxy white, except for small purple patches on each cheek. His eyes were closed, and Nancy said the lids were bluish. His lips also had a blue cast to them, and his neck, she said, had a kind of puffy look to it. His hair was sandy blonde, cut short but not so short that a little of it couldn't flutter on his forehead when the wind blew, which it did pretty much constant. Nancy says, "Mister, are you asleep? If you're asleep, you better wake up." Johnny Graveland says he's not asleep, Nancy. He's not unconscious either. He's not breathing. She said later she knew that. She'd seen it, but she didn't want to believe it. Of course not, poor kid. So she says, maybe he is asleep. You can't always tell when a person's breathing. Shake him, Johnny. See if he won't wake up. Johnny didn't want to, but he also didn't want to look like a chicken in front of his girlfriend, so he reached down. He had to steel himself to do it, he told me that years later after we'd had a couple of drinks down at the Breakers, and shook the guy's shoulder. He said he knew for sure when he grabbed hold because it didn't feel like a real shoulder at all under there, but like a carving of one, but he shook it all the same and said, "Wake up, mister, wake up," and he was going to say, "Die right," but thought that wouldn't sound so good under circumstances, thinking a little bit like a politician even back then, maybe, and changed it to, "And smell the coffee." He shook twice. First time nothing happened. Second time the guy's head fell over on his left shoulder. Johnny had been shaking the right one. And the guy slid off the litter basket that had been holding him up, went down on his side, his head thumped on the sand. Nancy screamed and ran back to the road fast as she could, which was fast, I can tell you. If she hadn't stopped there, Johnny probably would have had to chase her all the way down to the end of Bay Street, and I don't know, maybe right on out to the end of Dock A. But she did stop, and he caught up to her, and he put his arm around her, and he said he was never so glad to feel live flesh underneath his arm. He told me he's never forgotten how it felt to grip that dead man's shoulder, and how it felt like wood under that white shirt. Dave stopped abruptly and stood up. "I want a Coca-Cola out of the fridge," he said. "My throat's dry, and this is a long story. Anyone else want one?" It turned out they all did, and since Stephanie was the one being entertained, if that was the word, she went after the drinks. When she came back, both of the old men were at the porch rail, looking out at the reach and the mainland on the far side. She joined them there, setting the old tin tray down on the wide rail, and passing the drinks around.
"Where was I?" Dave asked after he'd had a long sip of his.
"You know perfectly well where you were," Vince said. "At the part where our future mayor and Nancy I know, who's God knows where, probably California. Good ones always seem to finish up about as far from the island as they can go without needing a passport, had found the Colorado Kid dead on Hammock Beach."
Well, John was for the two of them running right to the nearest phone, which would have been the one outside the public library, and calling George Warnes, who was the Moose Look constable in those days, long since gone to his reward, dear, ticker. Nancy had no problem with that. She wanted Johnny to set the man up again first. That's what she called him, the man, never the dead man or the body, always the man. Johnny says, "I don't think the police like you to move them, Nan." Nancy says, "You already moved him. I just want you to put him back where he was." He says, "I only did it because you told me to." To which she answers, "Please, Johnny, I can't bear to look at him that way, and I can't bear to think of him that way." Then she starts to cry, which, of course, seals the deal. He goes back to where the body was, still bent at the waist like it was sitting, but now with its left cheek lying on the sand. Johnny told me that night at the Breakers that he never could have done what she wanted if she hadn't been right there watching him and counting on him to do it. And you know I believe that's so. For a woman, a man will do many things that he'd turn his back on in an instant when alone, things he'd back away from 9 times out of 10. Even when drunk and with a bunch of his friends egging him on. Johnny said the closer he got to that man lying in the sand, only lying there with his knees up like he was sitting in an invisible chair, the more sure he was that those closed eyes were going to open and the man was going to make a snatch at him. Knowing that the man was dead didn't take that feeling away, Johnny said, but only made it worse. Still, in the end, he got there. He steeled himself. He put his hands on those wooden shoulders. He sat the man back up again with his back against that leaning litter basket. He said he got it in his mind that the litter basket was going to fall over and make a bang, and when it did, he'd scream. But the basket didn't fall, and he didn't scream. I am convinced in my heart, Steffi, we poor humans are wired up to always think the worst is going to happen, because it so rarely does. Then what's only lousy seems okay, almost good, in fact, and we can cope just fine.
Do you really think so?
Oh, yes, ma'am. In any case,
Johnny started away, then saw a pack of cigarettes that had fallen out on the sand. And because the worst was over, it was only lousy, he was able to pick them up, even reminding himself to tell Judge Wannis what he'd done in case the state police checked for fingerprints and found his on the cellophane, and put them back in the breast pocket of the dead man's white shirt. Then he went back to where Nancy was standing, hugging herself in her BCHS warm-up jacket and dancing from foot to foot, probably cold in those skimpy shorts she was wearing. Although it was more than the cold she was feeling, of course. In any case, she wasn't cold for long, because they ran down to the public library then, and I'll bet if anyone had had a stopwatch on them, it would have shown a record time for the half mile, or close to it. Nancy had lots of quarters in the little change purse she carried in her warm-up, and she was the one who called Judge Wannis, who was just then getting dressed for work. He owned the Western Auto, which is now where the church ladies hold their bazaars. Stephanie, who had covered several for Arts and Things, nodded. Judge asked her if she was sure the man was dead, and Nancy said yes. Then he asked her to put Johnny on, and he asked Johnny the same question. Johnny also said yes. He said he'd shaken the man and that he was stiff as a board. He told Judge about how the man had fallen over, and the cigarettes fallen out of his pocket, and how he'd put them back in, thinking Judge might give him hell for that, but he never did. Nobody ever did. Not much like a mystery show on TV, was it?
Not so far, Stephanie said, thinking it did remind her just a teensy bit of a Murder, She Wrote episode she'd seen once. Only given the conversation which had prompted this story, she didn't think any Angela Lansbury figures would be showing up to solve the mystery. Although someone must have made some progress, Stephanie thought. Enough, at least, to know where the dead man had come from.
Judge told Johnny that he and Nancy should hurry on back to the beach and wait for him, Dave said. Told him to make sure no one else went close. Johnny said okay. Judge said, if you miss the 7:30 ferry, John, I'll write you and your lady friend an excuse note. Johnny said that was the last thing in the world he was worried about. Then he and Nancy Arnaud went back up there to Hammock Beach, only jogging instead of all-out running this time.
Stephanie could understand that. From Hammock Beach to the edge of Moosey Village was downhill. Going the other way would have been a tougher run, especially when what you had to run on was mostly spent adrenaline.
Judge Wannis, meanwhile, Vince said, called Doc Robinson over on Beach Lane.
He paused, smiling remembrance, or maybe just for effect.
Then he called me.